God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the willingness to know the difference. Amen. Okay, our 40-minute speaker tonight is Ron from Huntington Beach. Thank you, Ron.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ron St. John, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Ron.
Very good. What a well-disciplined group this is. I'm impressed. Hi, truly. This does seem like a fun meeting. So, if you're new, get a commitment. I want to thank Carla for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege, and always an immense head rush for me to be able to speak in a meeting. I just love the sound of my own voice on a microphone, really. No matter how many times I hear myself speak, I always find it to be utterly fascinating. I want to thank my posse here, Gary and Joe, and my old friend John, and want to remember Rico, just because nobody else ever does. But you're all welcome, and I'm going to describe in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I will start from the beginning. I was born in the mid-1950s, believe it or not. Yes, I am that old. And we lived in a town you've heard of, but you've never been to, called Tombstone, Arizona. So you didn't think you'd ever know anybody from Tombstone, and now you do. I'm an authentic child of the American West. But I didn't really stay there long enough to join any posses or anything because my dad got out of the Army and we moved away when I was 9 days old. So I probably can't even find that place now. But we moved back to Michigan, where both of my parents were from, and that's where I grew up. My dad worked his way through college at the University of Michigan. We lived in a little tiny trailer to start out. If there's anybody else here that lived in a trailer, probably not here in an affluent place like San Clemente. Nope. Nah. Yeah, oh, manufactured home is a big upgrade from our little trailer. This is like you could touch both sides. And it's not like we were cooking meth and hiding out from the cops or anything. My dad was going to college. I got this obsession now of Breaking Bad. I know it hasn't been on in a while, but it's just whenever I'm in an AA meeting, because every newcomer is starting to look like Jesse Pinkman to me. Maybe not here in St. Clemente, but up in Newport, where I usually go, they like come up with their hats on backwards to read the chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail, bitch. Okay. Where was I going from that? Oh, yeah, Detroit. Yeah, so I was the oldest of 5 kids, and my dad eventually got a sales job, and he ended up working for IBM on computers, and my mom was a ballet teacher. So I got what every man here wishes he had, ballet lessons. Also, tap dancing and violin. So not a lot of pressure in my house to be all masculine. That didn't seem to be an issue. Any chance I had of being a badass from Tombstone was just gone. I was that skinny little Nelly who carried his violin to school in second grade. That was me. So, you know, I had no friends. Nobody liked me. I just felt sorry for myself. I tried to play sports, but I was really thin. And I liked sports, but, you know, like I think I'm the only person I know who got cut trying out for Pop Warner football. I don't even think that's possible now, but I'm sure that it happened to me. Because, you know, they, like, put you in the middle of this thing with your pads on and everything. You're supposed to knock another kid out of the circle if you've done that drill. I'm thinking somebody could get hurt doing this, you know? But then around the same time, I started doing theater, which turned out to be what came really easily to me. It was like I was in a college play. They had a child part, and they're like, it was a musical, and they said, just go up on stage and say, hey, lady, you want a guide? And so I went up on stage, and I said, hey, lady, you want a guide? And they thought I was a genius, and they thought, man, this is easy. And so I just I did that, you know, anything worth doing is worth doing obsessively, and so I just obsessed about it constantly. I read plays in the library, I listened to show tunes on the record player, I practiced for the practice, for the audition for the practice, and I was just, you know how we are, but got people to like me or pretend to like me, and it worked for a while. We're moving into the 1970s now. I'm becoming a teenager. I grow my hair really long, like really long, which was bad look for me, unfortunately. My hair just poofed out in this big jufro. It wasn't my fault. So I think about, I can't really make fun of the way young people look now, because you should have seen me. I had this long, poofy, curly hair, and I never washed it, and I would wear a hat with it to try to keep it all in one place, and I had this army jacket left over from the 50s. It was all beat up, and my bell bottoms, and my Let's Boogie t-shirt, you know. So people thought I was on drugs way before the time I really was on drugs. I just looked like, I know it's sort of an outside issue. It's not really an outside issue, like Obamacare, that's an outside issue. I saw some speaker recently said, yeah, drugs are such an outside issue that Bill Wilson doesn't start talking about it until page 6. But anyways, we learned about drugs from this film strip I'm old, and it was teaching us that a pusher was going to come to our school. He was going to give us free drugs so that we would get hooked, and then we would be addicts, right? You saw that film strip, some of you did. We waited for that guy. He never showed up. We had a chronic drug shortage. So it was like, you got to know. We were so pathetic we couldn't even get gas. You know, if they got gas, or there's in lines for gas, we couldn't get gas, we couldn't get drugs. It was rotten. But when I was 16, I finally did discover alcohol and also pot. And my life got much better. Because I could finally breathe. I could just finally feel okay. It completely changed the world. I felt like, I like you now, and you like me. The world is a different place. I just get one little bottle of Annie Green Springs or Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, and the world has changed. Or anything. I drank anything. If anything, we thought that alcohol was sort of bogus, really, because, we thought marijuana was very safe and sort of healthy. It's just a plant, and that it was terrible that it was illegal because alcohol is so much more dangerous and all. That's what we really thought. But I'm an alcoholic. So if you get me near alcohol, I'm going to drink as much of it as I possibly can, regardless of the politics of the situation. Anyways, when I was 17, my dad decided to do a geographic, and we moved back out to Arizona for no good reason. Turns out I'm the wrong person to be born in Arizona and graduate from high school in Arizona, because I just hate Arizona. There's people that like it. I still have family there. I just don't get why, really. If you have a choice, you live in any place else. Why you live in Arizona? But so I spent a year there kind of feeling sorry for myself. And but I got a scholarship, and so I got to go to any college I wanted to go to. So, of course, I decided to come out here to Hollywood to become a movie star. And I started out as a drama student at the University of Southern California. Go Trojans. That's right. It's a funny thing that USC people are always very well represented at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a party school, make no mistake. At least it was in the 70s. I loved it. Party, fun all the time. I don't get how you just drink every day of the week and then get a degree anyways and then get a good job. It just seems kind of bizarre, but that seemed to be how it worked in the 70s, and I really felt like I had, this is maybe an outside issue too, except they talk about it in the big book even more than alcohol, which is that I've always had kind of a problem with women, and I know that will come as a big shock to you, but I just fall in love really, really easily. Like, I can totally fall in love with a woman and be ready to grow old with her, and I still haven't seen what she looks like from the front. So, I think I was at freshman orientation at USC, and I met this girl. She actually lived in San Clemente. I thought that was kind of exotic. I didn't know where that was, but I knew that President Nixon lived down here, and she was just a princess. She was just so beautiful. Her name was Ellen, and I was, she was so incredibly beautiful, and I was so deeply in love with her that I knew I needed to never talk to her. Because it just might not go well. And I knew that I needed to never tell anyone else the way I felt, because then, you know how you rehearse conversations in advance? Like, what are they going to say? Well, why don't you talk to her? No, that's not going to work. Or then they just make fun of me, or then I talk to a different girl and they say, oh, what about Ellen? I didn't want that. And so I just kept this a huge secret. I never told a soul. I never said her name out loud. It feels funny for me to say it out loud right now. It's such a secret. But anyways, I joined a fraternity. It's where the free liquor was. Free liquor was very important to me. I was on a very tight budget, like about $20 a week, and that included food. So I think I went to a bar once. They tried to sell, like, this much gin for $3. And I was like, seriously? I do not have that many $3 in my pocket that this is ever going to work. Because I was wondering at AA meetings of all the people that went to bars. I keep thinking that must be the rich alcoholics. I like, you know, my favorite place was Lucky's, not a bar Lucky's, the grocery store, you know, where you can get it. And anyways, I also joined fraternities, free liquor, and that helped keep things in balance, and I absorbed as much of it as I possibly could. We went to this big party down at San Diego State, and, you know, if you're a connoisseur of party schools, San Diego State is just the stuff of legend. We thought they had parties all the time and the most beautiful women on earth, and we just couldn't wait to get down there. We talked about it for weeks, and we were so excited to get down there. Once we got down there, I'm sure we did this, and it doesn't seem appropriate for a bunch of 18-year-olds to be doing, but we just sort of camped out on the campus with a keg of beer, drank the beer, and watched the girls go by all day. And skipped dinner because, you know, beer has a lot of calories anyways, and if you skip dinner, you get drunk faster. I can't be the only one that figured that one out. And we went to this party at our San Diego State chapter, and they had a bar. I'd been thinking for a long time about how I wanted to be this tough guy who drank bourbon. I hadn't tried any bourbon yet, but I was ready to, and I was going to pick out a brand, and I was going to be a bourbon man. So I went up to the bar, and I said, have you got any bourbon? Like, yeah, we got bourbon for 50 cents a glass. Oh, that's a fair price. I think I will have... Okay, I stopped right there because that was the moment that time just disappeared. And the next thing I knew, I was in the back seat of a car. And the car was moving. And I was sitting next to this big woman. I sort of knew who she was because it was one of my fraternity brother's girlfriends. I never liked her. Just bouncing around the back of this car, and I'm looking outside, looking for clues, like, the different day, I saw Angel Stadium. I thought, okay, we're not in San Diego anymore. Why am I sitting next to her? And she starts asking me about Ellen. And I'm like, seriously? You know about Ellen? And she said, yeah, you've been talking about her for the last hour. And I'm like, what? She said, yeah, we stopped for gas in San Clemente, and you got out of the car and said you were going to go find her. I'm like, oh, that was not what I would have chosen to do. I counted the money in my pocket, and I figured out that I'd spent $4.50, which meant, and I tasted bourbon for days, and I'm pretty sure that means I had 9 bourbons. And that's kind of the part of the story. At the time, the only part of the story that bothered me was the fact that she knew about Ellen. But the part that bothers me now is just how self-destructive I am. I mean, I know I'm an alcoholic. I passed that test a long time ago. But here's me. I will drink enough, absent-mindedly, to do enough damage to my brain cells that I'm not able to retain memories anymore. And in that state of semi-consciousness, I'll drink 9 more bourbons. I don't know, it scares me now. It didn't at the time. And the only thing I did learn from that whole experience, don't drink bourbon. I never touched bourbon again, I swear. I've not had a drop of that stuff since that day in San Diego. Vodka was fine, rum, tequila, that was no problem. Gin was just like mother's milk to me. Gin was my best friend in the world. I could always trust gin. But, and it's how stupid we are, really. Oh, but not bourbon. This stuff tastes nasty anyways. Get that stuff away from me. I had a bad experience with that. It's ridiculous. But that's us. Anyways, I dropped out of the drama department. Yes, I did. Drama people were kind of weird. No offense if there's any drama people way down here in the OC. Probably not. But I wanted to be more normal, and plus I was way tired of people thinking I was gay. It's okay to be gay, but nobody ever seems to mean it as a compliment. I was just a skinny, long-haired drama student who knew a lot of show tunes. That didn't mean I wanted to have sex with other men. No. I had a different sexual problem, as I probably started to mention, and I will tell you guys about it since we're all so close. You have to keep it a secret, and that applies to people who are listening to me on the internet. The problem was that I wanted sex way more often than I was ever going to get it. Okay? And I don't mean I wanted it just a little bit and thought it might be nice. I mean I was in pain. My skin hurt, my hair hurt, everything. I needed to touch some girl parts or somebody was going to touch me. And I was very shy. I was afraid of girls, I was afraid of rejection, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because here's a secret, newcomer guys. What women find attractive in a man is self-confidence. They can't help themselves. That is what they are attracted to. Like this whole cliche about being attracted to the bad guy, they're not attracted to just any bad guy. They want the bad guy who's in charge of all the other bad guys. So if you just cower in the corner and you think, oh, she probably didn't like me, I better not bother, then that's, you know, it can't get anywhere. So alcohol was a complete solution to my problem. Because once I drank, I felt much more confident, and therefore I was more likely to succeed. My probability of success increased from about 0% to about 5%. That's a very significant difference. That's like once a month almost, you know. Plus then there's the demand side to the equation, because once you drink enough, who cares? Now I don't need it anyways. Now I don't care if I find her or not. Now I feel fine. And no offense to the women here, but you're kind of a lot of trouble. The relationship that you have with a bottle of Southern Comfort is very simple. You buy it, you pour it, you drink it. You don't have to wait for the bottle to be in the mood before you drink it, right? You don't have to be nice to its friends, you don't have to remember its birthday, and it doesn't care if you were drinking something else the night before. So that's what I did, night after night. I would leave for the party, you know, I'd put on my high karate and all and have lots of hope, and then I would drink, and then I would black out, and I would end up on the floor in my bathroom by myself. Not real glamorous. And which is, I'll just mention one more long-standing resentment, and then I'll find some other damn thing to talk about, which is, you know, I've been coming to AA for more than 23 years, which is 23 years of adorable women who come up to the podium and say, oh, I would drink, and then I would black out, and I just didn't know who I was going to wake up with. Okay. Where were you? Seriously. Okay, I'm probably exaggerating, because I did I came out of that time, I took that 20 questions, you know, like we were hearing before, and I got a lot of yeses, and that was kind of depressing, because I thought if anybody knows that I'm an alcoholic, then they're going to make me go to that AA thing, and I won't be able to drink anymore, and I know that I have a special kind of alcoholism, the kind where I still have to drink, but I know that if I try to explain that to anybody, it's just not going to come out right. So it's like secret, secret, secret. Here's another secret. Here's another secret. I became very secretive. I kept my drinking secret from guys who drink constantly. There's guys who would offer me a beer for breakfast, and I'm hiding some of my drinking from them. I'm keeping vodka in a hip flask. I'm pouring vodka into a can of grape soda so it looks like I'm drinking grape soda when I'm really drinking mostly vodka. Because you never know. Especially if I paid for the liquor myself, I was like hoarding it like a miser. And it was crazy. But I kept my drinking secretive and controlled, and that's what I did for maybe another dozen years or so until I got to my early 30s and had a midlife crisis and came in here. Which is why I just don't have as good of a story as I would like to have. But I didn't think I was creating an AA pitch. I thought that I was controlling and enjoying my drinking. If I'd known how many times I was going to have to tell this damn story, I would have done more funny things. As it is, I got married. I graduated from college. I went to law school. I graduated from law school. I became a lawyer. I had 4 kids. I know that sounds like a lot of people's success stories, but somehow I did it drinking, and it didn't feel like a success to me. I felt like a fraud and a failure, and like I was going to be exposed any moment, and that's another damn secret, and I didn't really make as much money as people thought I did, and I couldn't keep up with the credit cards and the mortgage and the kids and the house, and oh, poor me, and this is, I'm just miserable, and I can't quit my job, and it's boring, and it's stupid, and I don't want to do this, and oh my God. Feeling sorry for myself was like a part-time job back then. And that really, in reality, I had so much to be grateful for. I loved my kids. I loved the time I spent with my kids. I had this big crew of bizarre in-laws. My first wife was Italian, and so it was kind of indescribable, really. But I didn't appreciate that. I just felt sorry for myself. And, you know, if I got a spare minute to myself once in a while, I would sneak out to go to a topless bar so I could drink gin and watch pretty girls take off their clothes. Because everybody needs a hobby. Didn't really seem like a problem at the time. Felt and seemed like the only good part to my life. Hard to see that as a disease, you know. And my poor wife, I was sort of ignoring her because she started out so sweet and fun and friendly, and then, I don't know, she just got all grouchy after we got married, and I'm sure it was all my fault, but I still didn't want to hear about it. And it was like, what she was really trying to say to me was, I love you. Are you participating in this relationship at all? Show me something. Show me that you're involved. That's what she should have said, but she never said that. And anything that she did say sounded like nag, 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 nag. Why do you always blah, blah, blah? How can you never blah, blah, blah? When are you going to fix the blah, blah, blah? I called her Big Chief, We Need a New. Because it was like, we need a new car. We need a new kitchen. We need a new house. Where are we going on vacation? And just all I'm thinking, why can't I just die? I would like to die. I want to die of a disease that's not my fault and doesn't hurt too much. Maybe I could go to jail. I would like to go to jail. I'd be okay with it. This weekend would work for jail for me. I could go to jail for something I didn't do, maybe, and get out later and people feel sorry for me. That might work. So my poor wife, she would say, what are you thinking about? And I should have answered her honestly, I'm considering suicide or jail because you drive me crazy. That would have given our relationship a chance to work. It would have brought things to the surface. Instead, I just said, well, nothing, I'm just tired. So that's how much fun it was to be married to me. It's not like we fought all the time. We really never fought until we were going through a divorce, because it's impossible to fight with me because I don't fight back. You can beat me up, you can leave me alone, but you can't get into a fight with me because I don't fight back. If you beat me up, then I just feel sorry for myself, which is pretty much my hobby. And if you leave me alone, good. It's all good either way. I just can't stand confrontation of any kind. It makes me sick to my stomach. Sometimes I wonder how it is I managed to become a litigation attorney. I've done it for 33 years. It's getting creepy, really, but on my day off, I just don't want to fight. Not interested. You gotta pay me my hourly rate, then I'll fight. Otherwise, screw it. I don't care. You can lie to the world, you can hide your drinking from your friends and your family and your workplace, but you can't hide it from your own body. It keeps score. So I was in my late 20s and I had gout. Literally, I had gout. I had an ulcer. I had insomnia. Who gets gout? We get gout. I'm healthier now in my 50s than I was in my 20s because I don't drink. It really is that simple. All those health problems that I had to go to the doctor for, like every couple of months, managed to go away once I tricked myself into getting sober. But I tried everything else first. I tried therapy. I went through lots of therapy. I was a great therapy patient. I'm like the ideal therapy patient. I had a job. I had health insurance. I had symptoms. There's some health professionals that know, anytime, so let me give you my card. And I was a great patient. I would do whatever they told me to do and read the books and all. And I would exercise. I started going to the gym. And I would read self-help books. And none of those things are bad, but it's not a cure for alcoholism. And what did bring me into the 12-step world was in the spring of 1990 when my first wife, she was my angel. I like angel instead of Eskimo. I was speaking in Texas a while ago, and they never use that expression, Eskimo. They refer to your person that brought you to AA as your angel. She was my angel. She was my angel. So my first wife was my angel, besides bringing me four beautiful children, is that she did bring me into the 12-step world because she needed it. She just confessed this to what she had been doing after she suffered from a small heart attack. She had been abusing laxatives, like, big time. And so I had to get her into an inpatient program for bulimia. She had a serious, hardcore eating disorder. And her rehab was the most intense 3 weeks of my life. I don't know that it meant all that much to her, but it did to me. I just loved rehab. Rehab has got to be the greatest place in the world, really. I'll never understand people that complain about rehab. You sit around in your PJs all day talking about yourself. What could possibly be better than that? Somebody else does the cooking. You don't even have to cook for yourself. Insurance pays for it all. What a racket. I couldn't get enough of that place. I would go for the art support days and the crafts and the cafeteria food. I just loved it. And there's so much optimism because it's like, everybody has just found the secret to life, and now the life is going to get better, and they want to share it with the world, and they were all about to die a week from Tuesday, but now they've had their life saved, and they've hit bottom. And it's like, that's the most optimistic thing you can ever say, to say, I've hit bottom. That's like saying you're promising yourself that everything in your life from now on is going to go up. You have no idea that that's true. Whatever you've hit, stuff could still get way worse. You might not be hit your bottom yet. But in any event, you just feel that way in the rehab. And they give her all these books to read and such. They told me to come to the codependence group. I'm like, codependence? What's that? Oh, well, codependency. Listen, codependency is this disease. You probably never heard of it because we just made it up a couple months ago. But not only do you have it, but you're in denial about the fact that you have it. I'm like, wow. So I didn't... I did not stay in denial for long. I went to every bookstore in town and I bought any book that had codependency in the title. And I just read it and did all the exercises. I was calling myself a people pleaser for years until I finally looked around my life and realized I couldn't point to one single person who really was pleased. So here's my theory. If you're a people pleaser, just keep up the good work. But if you don't have a lot of people in your life who are pleased, you might as well stop accusing yourself of being a people pleaser. Okay? That's it. I did that, and I joined Adult Children Anonymous because I wanted to get better, and I was not willing to stop drinking, but I was at least willing to admit my dad probably had a problem. And so you work the first 3 steps, and you hold hands, and you say all your terrible secrets, and pretty girls come up and hug you. That was working for me as a good program, and I was doing that, and I read all the books that they gave her, like I said, including the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was really relating to it. Now, if there's a special club for people who were drinking while reading the big book, that's probably, just me again. Okay, this is a tough crowd. I was drinking straight Kahlua out of one of my kids' sippy cups. Don't act like you never did that. Because it was in the dishwasher and I wanted to take it out and drink out of it and put it back in the same place in case anybody was counting cups. Not that they were, but just in case, you know. But I'm reading, drinking, oh yeah, I can relate to that. Oh yeah, I can see myself in that. Maybe I am a certain type of heavy drinker. So I found out eventually from my ACA friends that I stopped drinking, but then I would start again. Because you know how we are when we try to stop drinking on our own, then there's an exception, and then there's a different rule. And it's like, the way that my brain works, and I assume it works the same for any other alcoholic, is there's a plus A, and then this, and then C, and minus D, and there's a me, so I should have a drink. That's just the end of every line of reasoning. But then I found out that you have to, not drink in order to accumulate the number of days since your previous drink, and then you gain prestige within the group based on that number of days, and you get chicks and such. So as OCD as I am about counting, that was the beginning of the end. That's when my life became completely unbearable, because no matter how much I needed or deserved a drink, or how much it shouldn't matter, I couldn't take one because I did not want to start over again on my days. I got so crazy then, I grew a full beard because I wanted people to know that I was insane. I was detoxing is what I was doing. My wife told me, if you grow a beard, I'm going to divorce you. So I grew the beard. But she didn't divorce me. It was painful. It's painful. It's just horrible detoxing. I had one detoxing experience that I remember really acutely because I was supposed to be in a 3-day trial up in Ventura, and we managed to settle the case the first day, and I did a really good job of settling the case. My client was so pleased. We paid $0. It was like a 3-way deal, and the judge smiled at me. He could see what a genius I was, and yeah, smart me, there we go. And it's 11:21 a.m. Notice wait, Your Honor, thank you, and I'm done. And nobody's expecting me anywhere. And the number of topless bars between Ventura, California and my office in downtown is a lot. And I'm white-knuckling my way on the 101 freeway, and I get back to my office, and I'm thinking about where I would like to sit, and my favorite dancer, and the glass of gin, and the bartender, and the flashing light, except that chair is empty because I'm not there. And I'm just going insane. I'm just throwing papers around. I just couldn't stand it. I'm pacing around. What's wrong with you, Mr. St. John? I called a doctor. I thought I was going to have to be hospitalized. I don't know what's wrong with me. I was detoxing. That's what was wrong with me. Objectively speaking, this is us when we detox and we go crazy like that. What was happening? Nothing. Nothing was happening. I was perfectly safe. A case scheduled for trial settled. How often does that happen? Every day. That's just very normal. It just meant I was free that day. I could go home. I could do work. It didn't make any difference. But I built all this up because then I so craved it and I so needed to take the edge off. And I knew it would make me feel better, except I couldn't do that because I didn't have enough. I didn't want to start over my days. I was insane. But I didn't drink. And then I went to a meeting that I was going to AA meetings by that time. Dreadful as that sounds, we've all hit the same bottom. We came here, we're the board. And I shared about it, honestly. And I figured, if everybody's going to hate me for it, I'll just go to a different meeting. But I just have to be honest. And they laughed, they thought it was funny, and they accepted me. And then anything else I had to go through after that, I knew that, well, I'm going to get back to people that understand that, and I'm going to tell this as a funny story, and then I'm going to have people that understand that. I was making human contact for the first time in a long time. And that became more important to me, and I got commitments at the meetings. Because instead of kicking me out, they just told me they liked me to get commitments. Having commitments for a social retard like myself is extremely important because it means I have to be in a certain place at a certain time and do a certain thing. And then other people know sort of where to find me, just in case, contrary to my expectations, they actually do want to get to know me. And so I'm starting to have a few friends, at least the people that I do commitments with. That's how AA has kind of worked for me. Now when I got about a year, I finally decided I was just so healthy that I needed to end my marriage, and I ran away from home, just packed up my Toyota, and started this new life. So, you know, that the stories you hear about people that hit bottom drinking, you know, I lost my family, losing the family, or the job goes bad, or there's the tax lien and the bankruptcy, and then there's the kids won't speak to you, and you lose your house, and that kind of thing. None of that happened to me while I was drinking. All of it happened to me after I got sober. I just had this lost it all in sobriety story. But at the same time, I was recovering my physical health. I was looking forward to things. I was doing a better job at work. I had, you know, people that I was in touch with, and the stuff I was going through, things were falling together at the same time as they were falling apart. I'm sorry to be so vague, but I met a pretty girl after I got separated who was relatively new in the group, and first I knew she was totally out of my league. This was like one of the most beautiful girls in history. I mean, seriously, she looked like Jane Jetson. She was just perfect. This beautiful redhead Swedish goddess, and she just walked over to me like the queen of the Vikings. Said, "I want you to come with us to Pacific Group." Okay. The pretty girl asked me to do something, I do it. I'm not more complicated than that. And I'm following her around a Pacific Group, and we just became friends, and we were friends for a few years, really, and then finally wore down her defenses, and we became a romantic item, and now we've been married for 18 and a half years. She was your speaker here a few weeks ago, which means the half of this group who isn't new might remember her. She was that pretty redhead who came and spoke. And in fact, really, no one knows me unless they know that I'm Julie's husband. I'd like, "Who are you? Who? Ron? Ron? Who? Who? Ron, you know, I'm Julie's husband." "Oh, yeah, that Ron. There we go." That's like my dad will say that. It's like, come on. I was thinking about that because I went to church for St. Joseph's Day. I was related to St. Joseph's Day, and then I realized why. It's because nobody would ever hear of me except for who I'm married to. You know, it's anyway. We all have time, thanks. Where am I? Oh, yeah, so I met Julie and all, and it's my life has come together, and we got married, and, things were never simple for us. I had four kids, was paying all my money in child support. She had three kids, she was paying all my money in child support, so we were a good match, and we sat around watching the people that we paid child support to buy stuff that we couldn't afford. It's kind of depressing. Not that we're bitter or anything, but you know, time takes care of that problem. We just did suit up, show up, do the next indicated thing. The worst thing that happened to us in sobriety happened on April the 19th, 2001, which is 13 years ago. It was when my stepson Jordan went away for spring break and didn't come back, because he was in a car crash and he was the only fatality. He died in a head-on collision out in the desert. It wasn't really alcohol-related, it just, boom, he was 17 years old, high school senior, just about to graduate from high school. And, you know, how do you survive something like that? We don't really know. We just didn't have any choice in the matter, but we didn't drink and we didn't stop doing our commitments and we stayed with AA. Because AA is such a permanent support group for any of those tragedies that happen. When that tragedy happened, everyone that we knew and people that we didn't know rallied to our side. I mean, newspapers were rallying to our side. The high school, the church, my work, Julie's work. But after a week, they forget about it. And you're still in shock. Something like that happens in a year, you're still in shock. You barely even know what just happened. But AA is always there. It's always there with the easy does it, keep it simple, one day at a time. That's just a durable thing for any kind of a crisis. And that's what we did. Just a few days after the tragedy happened, Julie was giving her literature report at our Sunday night meeting in Newport, because we just kept showing up and kept doing the deal. The same thing happened, it was 10 years ago when I ended up having throat cancer. It's depressing to get throat cancer. It definitely mars your spirituality and makes you a really rotten day. Somebody calls, oh, your tumors are malignant. That's just, it's still depressing me now. I think about it because I still have trouble swallowing food and all. They did get rid of the cancer, but it's a traumatic experience. And it was, I'll mention this because now I've survived two life-threatening diseases, alcoholism and cancer. I'm a 10-year survivor now, so I'm going to live a long time and die something else. But I can tell you the difference, because either one will kill you. Alcoholism will kill you just as dead as cancer. But with alcoholism, you don't get as much sympathy. It's not like anybody's going to form a prayer group for us or wear little yellow bracelets. Oh, you have alcoholism, how awful, I'm going to pray for you every day. Nobody ever says that. And we also never get diagnosed with that certainty. It's not like a half a dozen science geeks at UC Irvine aren't going to look at something in a microscope and tell you that you're an alcoholic. You're always going to have to wonder, am I? Now, our attitude as cancer patients is much different, too, because cancer treatment as such means that they will kill the cancer while almost killing you in the process with radiation or poison or chopping off body parts, you know. Last time I signed a consent form, they cut off a piece of my tongue. Ow. Alcoholism, nobody's going to cut off your tongue. Nobody's going to cut off anything. Nobody's going to poison you. Nobody's going to put you under radiation. Here's the treatment for alcoholism. You have to read the big book. You have to come to meetings. You have to get a sponsor. You have to get commitments. That's it. That's the treatment, no chemo. And then here's us when we hear that good news. Oh, no. My case isn't that bad. It would be like me going to the cancer center and saying, you know, I'm only stage 3. If I get to stage 4, I saw a lady whose tumor was way worse than mine, so I'm out of here, you know. That's what we do. Most of us, it's sad that most newcomers, we've got this simple program. It's not all that simple. It requires a lot of peer pressure and modeling and ongoing thing. That's why you have to go to meetings forever, basically. Sorry, it's one day at a time, but always, because you're still the same lunatic that you were who poisoned yourself in the first place. It's not like, with the cancer now, I'm not going to go back and get more radiation. I don't have any more tumors. There's no more reason for it. So when you're done, you're done. But you're never done with this, because I still have the same stupid brain that poured 9 bourbons into me after I'd already blacked out. And so I have to, and I need peer pressure. I can't just learn it from a weekend or a book or something. I have to participate in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how the recovery works for me. Okay, so let me tell you that if you stay sober for 23 years, there's certainly no guarantee that you're going to have a great house by the beach and that you're going to have a wonderful job and that you're going to drive a brand new car and be married to a beautiful redhead, even though that is what happened to me. What we do guarantee is you get to sleep through the night and you get to wake up in the morning with a clear head and a clear conscience. And I can tell you with confidence that whatever crap you have to deal with in between meetings, the solution is always the same. Suit up, show up, do the next indicated thing. Take one day at a time. The past is gone. You can't do a damn thing about it. The future belongs to God. What we live in is today, one day at a time. That's what we pay attention to. We try to stay positive and stay in the solution. If that's going to work for me on the death of a child and a bankruptcy and a major tax lien and a work problems and cancer and everything else, the divorce, all the looks we had to deal with, I'm pretty sure it's going to work for the tragedies that are going to dog you in sobriety with no easy exit at the bottom of a glass. Because, you know, at the bottom of a glass, that stuff is just gone. It just doesn't matter anymore, even if it is happening. But we have to learn to deal with life sober. And as we take life one day at a time, all those anxiety attacks do dissipate. The ones you experience, it's 100 on a scale of 1 to 100. The next time it hits you, it'll only be a 98. Then it'll be a 96. Then it'll be a 95. Give yourself a year or two, and you'll barely notice them anymore. And you keep coming to the meetings, and all of a sudden you look back and you wonder, gosh, my life sure has gotten an awful lot better, and you can barely understand why. So if you want to live that way, you can. You keep coming to these meetings. You do the stuff that we do. This is a good meeting to come to. We'll be here. You do what we do, and your life gets better. Thanks for letting me share.